today.
That is Office of Lawyer Regulation versus Michael G. Trewin. Mr. Trewin is representing himself, and the Office of Lawyer Regulation is represented by Julie Marie Spoke. The Chief Justice, who normally sits in this chair, is not present, obviously, but she will be participating in this case. We'll start then with Mr. Trewin. You may proceed, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court, this is an action involving attorney discipline. I would like to address the issue of the Groshek claim first. The referee found that there was a violation of ethics in my dealing, having business transactions with the Grosheks, in that essentially there was self-dealing and there was not informed consent. The facts of Groshek, summarized briefly, is that back in 2004, shortly before my license was to be suspended for business dealings with other clients, I reached an agreement with the Grosheks to lend to them. At the time, I gave them a written waiver of conflict of interest that they were to review with an attorney. It was mailed out to them. They received it several days before they signed it. They came back. They also received a proposed lease as I would be buying the property, selling some of the land off to a neighbor, and then leasing the remainder of the property back to them. We then met after they reviewed the waiver and the proposed lease. I believe it was the August 30th. There was discussions and negotiations had at that point, changing the option price in the lease. And at that point, the Groshek signed the written waiver of conflict of interest and the written waiver of conflict of interest. Now, what's interesting in this particular case is that after the August 30th date, at that point, I went to my bank to see if I could get the money in order to do that, which they agreed to do. The bank that held the mortgage on the Groshek property refused to go through with the sale as they had concerns about me as the Groshek's former attorney buying the property. And the deal was over. At that point, I was no longer practicing law. I went to work making sausage at a venison processing company. And the matter was over until in late October of that same year, the Groshek's, through their attorney, contacted me to ask if I would purchase that property, their property. It was an unsolicited letter. They had apparently reached some type of an agreement with the bank to settle with the bank, but since they didn't have the money to fund the settlement, they wanted me to purchase the property and lease it back to them. In the trial, when Groshek's sued me for rescission of that deed, there is a copy of the letter from Attorney Morrow to me indicating that they wanted to sell the property to me. The terms were substantially different than the offer that was discussed on on August 30th of that year. But essentially, I was to purchase the property and lease it back to them with an option to purchase. Now, in that trial, all of the parties testified that Attorney Morrow was representing the Groshek's. The Groshek's testified that Attorney Morrow was their attorney. Groshek's counsel objected numerous times to Attorney Morrow testifying at trial based upon attorney-client privilege. Attorney Morrow testified that he was representing the Groshek's, and obviously I testified that he contacted me as their attorney to enter into this transaction. Yet despite this testimony, the trial court decided that Morrow was not representing the Groschecks, but was simply a scrivener in the matter. While I wasn't representing the Groschecks at the time that the transaction closed in November of 2004, it is clear that, A, I had them sign a written waiver of conflict of interest, indicating that they knew that I was not representing their interests in the transaction. B, I advised them to contact another attorney to represent their interests, and they, in fact, did contact another attorney to represent their interests. For the first time, 2 years after when the Groschecks sued me for rescission, for the first time, they raised the issue of whether or not the transaction was fair. The Groschecks were being allowed to satisfy the bank's obligation on their property for $200,000, an obligation that on its face value was $320,000 or $380,000, substantially more than the $200,000 that they were going to be paying. The Groschecks argued that the property that was being sold to me for $92,000 was actually worth $180,000, or essentially nearly everything that the bank was owed, and claimed that the deal was not fair to them. There was never any testimony at trial by a realtor or an appraiser indicating what the property's value was worth. The only evidence of valuation was in the form of an appraisal that was done by the bank that set the value of the entire property at $204,000. The referee, in finding that there was a violation of Supreme Court rules in dealing with Groschecks, indicates that the transaction was unfair to them, and in addition, the referee went so far as to say that it's unlikely that if an independent counsel were to review the documents, that they would recommend that the Groschecks enter into it. In specific, I'm reading from page 49 of the referee's decision. There is simply no way that any disinterested attorney would have recommended that any of the three clients have been represented by Trewin and have entered into the land transactions in question. In fact, even if the grievance had not been Trewin's clients at all, but instead had been complete strangers off the street, it is doubtful that an attorney could be found who would have recommended entering into these real estate transactions. Well, clearly that's not the case. We have in Groschek an attorney who was representing them, who contacted me 2 months after the deal was canned to reinstate the deal. So the referee is making assumptions about the deal being so unfair that no attorney would recommend it, when in fact the evidence is the absolute opposite. There was an attorney involved representing Groschecks that found that the deal was not only advantageous, but that they wanted to enter into it after it had previously died out. The referee in the current proceedings has indicated that this transaction, as well as the other transactions, may be void as fraudulent or not complying with the statute of frauds. Again, there's nothing in the OLR complaint that pleads with any particularity any fraudulent conduct. With Groschek, using, sticking with Groshek to begin with, the type of transaction that we have is something that's currently referred to, or commonly referred to, as a triple net lease, where a debtor...
Counsel, did it ever occur to you that you're getting yourself in repetitive trouble by having financial dealings with your clients? You do it over and over and over, and I understand your discussion of it, and I appreciate your discussion of it, but you put yourself, by your own actions, in a position you don't need to be in. Did it ever occur to you that's just bad judgment on your part, if nothing else?
Well, yes. Yeah, it did occur to me. And to be honest with you, I initially turned down the Groshek. I said that I'm not going to do the...
The only folks you do these kind of deals with. I mean, they're all a little different, but it's with a client.
Again, the Groshek is the only person that I had dealings with after the OLR, first OLR proceeding, that wasn't people that I was already tied into prior to the first OLR decision. With regard to the Groshek, I did not want to do that. And, in fact, I told them. There's testimony at the trial from my wife indicating that they called her to ask her to do the transaction. One thing maybe most of you probably don't understand, but I came into law, I practiced debtor-creditor law. I was a bankruptcy attorney representing the debtors almost exclusively. And with regard to every one of these clients, I felt sorry for them, which is a bad reason to get involved. First of all, I'm not a wealthy person. You know, I shouldn't be doing this for that reason alone. I should be taking care of my family versus putting my livelihood on the line trying to help these people out. But I honestly believed that what I was doing was helping them. With regard to the Groshek's, by structuring the deal as a sale to me and a lease back to them with an option to purchase, they were able to save somewhere in the neighborhood of $70,000 in taxes. And bigger than that, they were able to get all of their personal property that they needed for their logging or for their sawmill operation. They were able to get that free and clear of the bank's lien because they were able to settle with the bank. That was a big plus for them. And they're sympathetic people.
I hear what you're saying. But, you know, you put yourself in a position that you don't need to be in. And sometimes the better part of wisdom is to say, I feel your pain, but that's the most I can do for you.
I understand, and for that, I am to blame. However, I did think that I was complying with the rules at the time by having them sign a written waiver of conflict of interest and by having them obtain independent counsel.
Mr. Trewin, I take it that you... disagree with the sanction that's been recommended by the Office of Lawyer Regulation and by the referee. What is your position as to what sanction should be imposed here?
Your Honor, if any sanction is... I don't believe that a revocation is an appropriate sanction, and the Office of Lawyer Regulation has cited a number of cases in seeking revocation of law license. But all of those cases involved criminal conduct or theft of property from a client without their knowledge. In every one of these cases, the clients were knowledgeable about what was taking place, and they were informed. They received compensation. I mean, Groshek received $92,000 up front. Daryl Hurley, the Hurleys, they received $275,000 up front. The Van Strattons, interestingly enough, they were part of the first OLR proceeding where I purchased their property after it went to foreclosure in order to rent it back to them, and I gave them the option to purchase under that rental agreement. the money that was advanced to Van Strands after the OLR proceeding was, I think, $3,500 to purchase 3.5 acres of land next to their property so that they could have a bigger garden, because Mr. Van Stratton raised vegetables to sell to people that, you know, sell at the Quick Trips and, you know, those stands. All of the clients received money from, it wasn't me taking their money and then not giving it back to them. It was them getting money from me with an option to purchase, and ultimately for the Groshek's and for the Hurley's, they weren't able to make the payments at later on, and they ended up defaulting on the notes. I think that's a big difference between somebody who without the consent of the client takes their money or takes the property without any consideration with the you know, tacit understanding that I'm going to give it back to you later on and then doesn't give it back to them. So I do believe that the sanction that they're seeking is far in excess of what it should be. In this particular case, we're dealing, now granted, this is the second time I'm in front of you, and I'm embarrassed by that myself, but we're talking three different cases here. The first case, I think there was an allegation of in excess of 10. The dollar amounts in this particular case are less than the dollar amounts that were involved in the first case. And again, the only new person that we're dealing with is the Groshek's. Hurley's and Van Stratton's, I was already involved with at the time of the first, and they were claimants in the first OLR proceeding. I felt an obligation to try to work things out with them versus simply putting them in foreclosure when there was or evicting them from the property on the Van Stratton's when they weren't able to make payments. So I do believe that if there is to be a sanction, I think that it should be more in line with what was doled out the first time.
Counselor, how'd you come up with the 14% interest that you're charging?
There was, initially, and I don't know that there's been 14% charged since before the first OLR proceeding. I believe that the interest rate charged after that was between 11 and 12%. For nearly all of this. I base it in large part on two things. One, what I borrow money from the bank, and at the time that I was charged the 14% interest, I believe my line of credit was at 9%. So, but even then, I wouldn't have charged 14% interest if it was a long-term debt, but it was an operating loan of, I think, $3,000. So the total interest that we were talking about by the end of the year was going to be a very small amount. I think it ended up being somewhere around $100, $150. The difference between 12% and 14% wasn't much because we're talking a very small loan. But the later loans were almost all at 12% or less.
Do you dispute, counsel, any of the factual findings in regard to the Groshek's? And in particular, I'm referencing your letter to the First National Bank in regard to obtaining a loan. And in that letter, apparently you stated that you were looking to buy the real estate the Groshek's owned for $195,000. And you indicated that just a few months earlier, you said in the letter, the same land had been appraised at $208,000, which you felt was a very, quote-unquote, conservative appraisal. Is that true?
That's correct. Now.
And then you indicated to the bank that as soon as you obtained the Groshek's land, you were going to sell about 40 acres of it immediately to some of the Groshek's neighbors for a little bit over $100,000, and you had a plan to subdivide the rest. Is that all true?
That is all true. I sent that letter to the bank.
And at this time, counsel, you were the attorney for the Groshek's?
I believe that the date of that fax, it was a fax that I sent to the bank, was the day that I sent the draft of the written waiver of conflict of interest to the Groshek's. We had discussed.
So the answer to my question is yes.
Yes.
Did the thought not occur to you that as their attorney, that they could reasonably expect of their attorney, who is purportedly attempting to help them, that the attorney would raise the subject of the possibility of the Groshek's themselves selling the land, the 40 acres, for $100,000?
We had, in fact, discussed that.
I beg your pardon?
We had, in fact, discussed that. We had talked to the Groshek's, and ultimately that's what they ended up doing. They ended up selling the 40 acres to the neighbors, the PA6, for roughly $100,000, and then selling the remainder of the land to me. We had had discussions when they first – this was an evolving matter with the Groshek's. The Groshek's initially – wanted to do a bankruptcy plan of reorganization. By July, they started having trouble making the payments, which is when I contacted the bank to see if there was a possibility of settling with the bank. In July, I got the bank to agree to take $200,000. Groshek's had, they thought, relatives that they were going to be able to borrow the money from, and a friend that they said had money. So between, I think it was July 3rd or July 6th, it was right around the 4th of July, between that time and the end of August, the Groshek's were actually trying to raise the money themselves from their family, from this friend that had money. And I believe that they went to a couple banks. All that took place, and it was only after they weren't able to get the money themselves from their friends or family or banks that they contacted me in middle to the end of August to see if I would be willing to do it. And they knew that I had been upfront with them, told them that I was going to have my license suspended, so they knew that I had loaned money to the clients, which is why they pressured me, I guess, to do something for them. And I want to go back to that letter to the bank. One of the things that I had talked to specifically with the Groshek's was subdividing the rest of the land in order to get their debt to zero. And they initially thought that that was a good idea. By the time that they came in to sign the written waiver of conflict of interest on the 30th, they no longer wanted to do that, at which time I contacted the bank, told them that they weren't interested in subdividing the rest of the land. They'd just be looking at selling – it would be me because I was borrowing the money. They'd just be looking at selling the 40 acres to the neighbor and then retaining the rest with Groshek's having the option to purchase. So it's not like this was something devious done behind their back. It was – and there's no agreement, you know, from the 30th on when we entered into this – that called for any of that.
Unless I'm mistaken, and I may be because of the length of this record, it was your intent, it was your stated intent to subdivide the remaining property.
I had discussed that with the Groshek's, yes. And when they said that ultimately that they didn't want to do that, then the bank was contacted and was told that we aren't subdividing any more of the property. We're going to sell the 40 acres to the neighbor. And that deal fell apart.
How many of the acres did you wind up with for the 94,000?
It's been a long time. I think it was around 30 acres.
Okay. And I think a minute ago you just referenced that the Groshecks were under the impression that you were going to hold it for them to repurchase at some point.
No, it was under a lease with an option to purchase. I gave, at the time that I purchased it, the same day that we closed that, they were given a lease with an option to purchase. Their attorney had reviewed it, had made a number of changes to the lease with option, including the price of the option, and that was signed the very same day.
Is that the attorney that the circuit court referred to as a scrivener?
That's correct.
And was it... What was the, you say they had an option to repurchase. What were the conditions of precedent for them to exercise the option?
I believe that the conditions were that they had to be current on their rent, and I believe that there was a provision that they couldn't exercise the option until after 12 months, so that it would be deemed as long-term capital gains when I sold it.
Thank you. I see the red light is on.
Attorney Spoke, on behalf of the OLR.
May it please the court, my name is Julie Spoke, and I represent the Office of Lawyer Regulation in the pending disciplinary proceedings against Michael G. Trewin. Just to kind of briefly address some of the things with the Groshek transaction that Mr. Trewin has brought up. It's my understanding that as it relates to Attorney Morrow, who was involved in the transactions, he was not involved in the initial agreement and conflict waiver that was signed in August of 2004. So the Grosheks did not have any representation at that time, which was signed the day before his license was suspended. It's my understanding from the record that Attorney Morrow was counsel that was, I believe, referred to them by Attorney Trewin to handle their bankruptcy matter. He was not hired to handle the land transaction between Trewin and the Groshecks. If he wasn't, I don't know if he was actually referred by Trewin, but the record might reflect that. It's my understanding that he was only handling the ending of the bankruptcy proceeding, and the trial court did find that he was just a scrivener in the real estate transaction. I don't recall any evidence on the record that he actually reviewed any of the documents, requested any changes. Mr. Trewin's testimony of that today is the first time I heard of that, and I don't know if it's on the record.
Is there any indication in the record that Attorney Trewin did contact the bank and advise the bank that the plan to subdivide the property would not go forward?
I'm not aware of any evidence that he contacted or called the bank telling them that they weren't going to subdivide.
And to the best of your knowledge, was his recitation of the conditions precedent for the exercise of the option for repurchase by the Groshecks an accurate recitation?
I'm not exactly sure. I'd have to refer to the lease agreement on that one.
Well, if we assume that what he said is true, what is the specific defect in the transaction with the Groshecks?
And what is it true in terms of them repurchasing their property under the lease agreement?
As well as the indication, I don't know if there's anything, and he just told us that he called the bank and said that the plan to subdivide the property was over, and you do, your office has a burden of proof?
Well, it's my understanding that the Groshecks were not aware and were not informed that he had any plans to subdivide the property, and it's my understanding in terms of the trial testimony that they testified that they were never informed of that.
All right.
From
and
the
that,
get-go.
And that is borne up out by what is in the record, which are the discrepancies between the letter to the First National Bank and the letter to the Groshecks.
Correct. And I believe that at some point there was a sale sign that was put up on the Groshecks' property later on, And I believe the testimony in the trial record is that Mrs. Groshek was shocked and wasn't aware that Mr. Treenwood could actually sell their property from underneath them. This court previously disciplined Mr. Treenwood in disciplinary proceedings against Treenwood, which is 2004 WI-116. This court previously suspended Mr. Treenwood for 5 months for loaning his clients money and engaging in various business relationships with his clients, which is also the same type of misconduct that is alleged in the current disciplinary case. In the previous case, he was found to have violated SCR 20:1.8A by entering into debtor-creditor relationships with his clients without securing written informed consent waivers, and also by virtues of numerous errors that he had made on his loan accountings to his clients. He also had been found to violate SCR 20:1.7B by entering into lender-debtor relationships with his clients without advising them in writing of the possible adverse effects of entering into business transactions with his clients and obtaining their written consent. He was also found to have violated SCR 20:8.4C by assigning various loan interests to his brother-in-law in order to hide his conflict of interest. The referee stressed in his opinion in the previous disciplinary matter that the frequency and magnitude of the loan and business transactions in which respondent participated with his clients were such that they appeared to be a common occurrence to respondent's practice, making it look as though he was more of a banker rather than a lawyer. None of the typical disclosure protocol a bank would follow was used by Treenwood. This type of activity was unfair and unreasonable to each and every client where such activity occurred. Despite being sanctioned in 2004 for this same type of misconduct, for loaning his clients money, for entering transactions in which he would buy his clients' property, Treenwood still continued to engage in these same types of transactions. Just even to illustrate the egregiousness of the misconduct, as we've already discussed, Treenwood had the Groshek's sign an agreement and conflict waiver the day before his license was suspended. He told them that he had to do this before he lost his license. And despite being sanctioned, Treenwood still believes it's acceptable to continue to loan his clients money and purchase their property from them as long as he gives them a sheet of paper which states that they were advised of the fact that they had a right to meet with an attorney and advised of a potential conflict of interest. Treenwood's response is that he just couldn't cut his clients off at the time of the previous disciplinary proceeding and that he still had to maintain his relationship and continue to loan his clients money. Furthermore, even more astounding is even after he was first sanctioned for failing to maintain proper records and adequate accountings, he still failed to obtain his client's signatures on promissory notes and conflict waivers for each and every transaction with his clients. He failed to maintain separate files documenting the loans, property transfers, and leases between him and his clients. He failed to provide his clients with documents specifying all the material terms and conditions of all the transactions. He failed to provide his clients with any satisfactions regarding any of the loans that were either paid off or were rolled into larger loans. He failed to maintain proper accounting of his clients' monies, whether or not it was a lease payment or a loan payment. He failed to provide his clients with amortization schedules. And except for providing them with a basic conflict waiver, he failed to provide his clients with an explanation of the potential conflicts and consequences in entering into these type of relationships with Mr. Treenwood as their attorney, the potential risks of his continued representation of them, and what alternatives might have been available to those clients at the time. Mr. Treenwood displays an utter lack of understanding of what is required of him if he is going to enter into these type of transactions with his clients. Mr. Treenwood is a fiduciary. He's in a fiduciary relationship with these clients. As a fiduciary, he owes these clients unfettered loyalty. Yet despite that, he engaged in conduct in which he had a pattern of self-dealing. Just as, for example, some examples with the Van Strattens. The Van Strattens went to Mr. Trewin for a reverse mortgage. Because there's no document explaining what exactly happened during this transaction, we don't know. The Van Strattens are adamant that they thought they were getting a reverse mortgage. They had no idea they were deeding their property over to Mr. Trewin. Mr. Trewin, on the other hand, indicates that he informed them that he couldn't do a reverse mortgage and that he would actually have them deed their property over to him instead for $3,500. That is the same property that the Van Strattens just previously had purchased from a neighbor for, the evidence is kind of sketchy, but it's like $4,000 to $4,500. There's nothing in writing explaining to the Van Strattens that the terms of deeding the property over to him. Mr. Trewin alleges that he informed them that if this was going to occur, that he was going to withdraw their land contract and enter into a life lease with them for both their homestead property and the 3.5 acres that that was currently being deeded over to him. There's even no evidence that a life lease even existed. The Van Strattens testified that they thought that they were still making payments on their land contract for their homestead. There is no conflict waiver for this transaction. So there is nothing even explaining what alternatives the Van Strattens may have had at that time other than deeding their property over to Trewin. We don't know if maybe it was possible if they looked into other banks that maybe they could have received a reverse mortgage from a different bank, or maybe they could have received a loan for $3,500. Plus, in this transaction, we don't know where the $3,500 went. When you look at Trewin's amortization schedules, there's nothing indicating that they were credited the $3,500, that they received a check for the $3,500. So we don't even know what happened to the $3,500 in that transaction. All we know is that now Mr. Trewin sits on the Van Strattens property. He now owns their homestead property. He has a deed to their 3.5 acres, and they're making rental payments to him. Also with the Hurleys. The Hurleys, it's disputed as to how it came about that the Hurleys ended up deeding their property over to Mr. Trewin. The Hurleys insist that Mr. Trewin told them that this was the only way to get out of a tax that was owed. Mr. Trewin indicates they came to him for a loan. Regardless, Mr. Trewin told the Hurleys their only option was to deed over to the Hurleys their land for $275,000. Mr. Trewin admits that this property was worth $350,000 to $400,000 at the time of the deed transfer. Therefore, Mr. Trewin is benefiting. He's receiving property with equity of $75,000 to $125,000. Mr. Trewin also knew that there were mega farms in the area that were extremely interested in the Hurley's property that would buy it at any time. As owner of the property...
Did he have an attorney-client relationship with the Hurley's at that time?
Yes. It was found by the referee that he had an ongoing attorney-client relationship with the Hurley's throughout this whole entire time.
Thank you.
Including during this transaction. Trewin was profiting. He was receiving rental payments on this property by virtue of a milk assignment. There was no writing discussing the totality of the agreement. There was a basic conflict waiver and lease agreement. However, those documents were in terms of giving the land to Daniel Schomer, Trewin's brother-in-law, which it's my understanding never actually occurred in this case. All the property was actually transferred over to Mr. Trewin, and Mr. Trewin was the owner of the lease agreement.
Ms. Spolk, why are you recommending revocation here?
Well, revocation, the OLR believes, is the appropriate sanction in this case. Mr. Trewin was disciplined previously for the same exact type of misconduct. The OLR feels that the nature of this misconduct, the continuing business transactions, the fraudulent nature of these business transactions warrants the revocation of Mr. Trewin's license. The OLR did cite to a few cases in support of its recommendation. And this case, the OLR believes, is very similar to cases such as disciplinary proceedings against Proust. In Proust, Proust had clients loan him money. He informed them he was going to pay them back. He just never paid them back. He also brought an elderly woman to the bank with him and deceived her into giving him a money order. He indicated he would pay her back after she realized that she had been deceived. However, he never paid these individuals back. I believe, OLR believes that Mr. Truman's case is very similar to that. Also, in disciplinary proceedings against Knickmeyer, Attorney Knickmeyer defrauded his client. He had the client give him loans, which he had promised he would pay him back. He never paid him back. He had the client buy a motorcycle and an airplane. The client actually signed the documents and agreed to all of this, but Mr. Knickmeyer was found to have never had the intent to pay his client back for these items. Both of those cases are very similar to the case that we have at hand. OLR believes that Truman has a selfish motive, that he's engaging in a lot of self-dealing in these transactions. He's receiving a profit to the detriment of his clients. He has a pattern of misconduct. We have multiple offenses here. We alleged 15 counts of misconduct, 14 which were found by the referee. He failed to provide all the documents that OLR had requested despite multiple requests by our committee members, by our OLR investigator. During discovery, we had asked for these documents. Some of the documents we received the day of trial, and we still don't have all the documents.
Did the referee make a finding as to whether Mr. Trewin made use of any of the information that he learned during the course of his attorney-client relationship with any of these parties in order to formulate the structure of the proposals for the real estate transactions?
I don't think there's anything actually specific in there, but the findings of fact by the referee do support that determination. I believe the referee made findings that Trewin, you know, the clients had come to him in bankruptcy and foreclosure actions. He knew their detailed financial information. He also became aware of the value of the client's property. He knew that there were neighbors or mega farms that had interest in these properties. And all that information that he had learned during these proceedings, because we're talking about debtor-creditor matters, so obviously he's going to learn how much money they make, what their financial situation is, how much debt they owe, and he obviously used that in entering into these transactions with his clients. And I believe that's supported by the referee's report.
Was Mr. Trewin charged criminally on anything that he did?
No, he has not been charged criminally.
If his license to practice law is revoked, could he engage in some of these transactions as a business person?
I can't forecast the future if he would. I believe, though, at least in this instance, that Mr. Trewin was using his status as an attorney and his relationship with these clients as their attorney in order to engage in these transactions. And we're talking about unsophisticated farmers who did not understand what was going on. They didn't understand the totality of the transactions. They all testified that they believed Mr. Trewin, they relied on him, they trusted him as their attorney, and they believed as their attorney that he was acting in their best interests. So there's nothing to prevent him from engaging in these type of transactions as a business person if his license is revoked, but I think it's significant that he's using his license and his status as an attorney in order to engage in these transactions with these clients. What I'd like to do next, then, is just go through some of the findings of the referee in this case. First, the referee found that Mr. Trewin violated SCR 1.8A by engaging in business transactions with his clients. 1.8A provides that a lawyer shall not enter into a business transaction with a client or knowingly acquire an ownership, possessory, security, or other pecuniary interest adverse to a client unless, first, the transaction and terms on which the lawyer acquires the interest are fair and reasonable to the client and are fully disclosed and transmitted in writing in a manner that can be reasonably understood by the client. Two, that the client is advised in writing of the desirability of seeking and is given a reasonable opportunity to seek the advice of independent legal counsel. And three, the client gives informed consent in a writing signed by the client to the essential terms of the transaction, as well as the lawyer's role. The referee properly concluded in this case that all the terms and conditions of the transactions were not fully disclosed and transmitted in writing. The referee properly concluded that only the terms favorable to Mr. Trewin were actually set forth in writing, and the referee properly concluded that the transactions lacked informed consent because they were either not consensible or there was no informed consent in writing. Trewin believes that as long as he provided his clients with this basic promissory note and this basic written conflict waiver that he had them sign, that violations of the Supreme Court rules just does not exist. His argument misses the boat. First, as the referee found, the transactions were not fair and reasonable to the clients, and the terms of the transactions were not fully disclosed in writing. For example, none of the transactions contained the appraised values of the client's properties or disclosed that the actual sales price was below the appraised value. In addition, none of the transactions explained the profit that Trewin would be making on the transactions. Also, in none of the transactions did Trewin explain that he was not obligated to place in writing and comply with all the terms and conditions and disclosures that's required by a banking institution, and that he was not going to comply with that. Also, in none of the transactions did Trewin disclose that the loans were being paid off or what loans were being paid off or satisfied as a result of a new note or a property transfer. Furthermore, in none of the transactions did Trewin inform his clients he would not be maintaining contemporaneous documentation or schedules of the payments that they were making on their loans and lease payments. Trewin also failed to inform his clients that his continuing to loan money to them after they had deeded their property to him would actually hinder their ability to buy their property back by virtue of the language of the actual lease assignments. And with the Hurleys, their future conflict waivers indicated that they had to pay all of their loans off to Mr. Trewin before they could even consider buying back their property. In addition, Trewin failed to inform some of his clients that the transactions were invalid from the get-go. Mr. Trewin did not inform the Van Strattens that their land contract was never recorded. He also failed to inform the Van Strattens that their quitclaim deed to him for the 3.5 acres was never properly recorded. Also, in none of the transactions did Trewin explain to his clients the material risks of entering into a transaction with their attorney, how his interests may conflict with their interests in continuing transactions in which he represented them, or indicate the alternatives that might be available to them. Second, as the referee properly found, the clients were not truly given the opportunity to seek the advice of independent counsel. Often, these transactions with Mr. Trewin were rushed. The clients testified that they would come in to see him, he would throw documents in front of them, they would sign what was ever placed in front of them without question. In addition, as the referee found, Trewin knew that the clients wouldn't seek the advice of independent counsel because, one, they couldn't afford to. He knew their financial circumstances. He knew that they wouldn't go out and pay another attorney to independently review these transactions. And he also knew that they trusted Trewin as their attorney. And at times, Mr. Hurley even said that he thought of Mr. Trewin as a friend. Third and most importantly, there was no informed consent in writing. Informed consent in writing would include discussing the material risks of the proposed transactions with the attorney, discussing any risks presented by the attorney's involvement, including the attorney's financial or personal interest in the transaction that may affect his advice, discussing the existence of available alternatives, and discussing why the advice of independent counsel is advisable. In all the transactions that Truman had with his clients, including his conflict waivers, none of the required disclosures were present. The referee also properly found that Mr. Truman violated SCR 20:1.7b. SCR 20:1.7b provides that a lawyer shall not represent a client if that representation may be materially limited by the lawyer's own interests, unless 1, the lawyer reasonably believes the representation will not be adversely affected, and 2, the client consents in writing after consultation. The consultation shall include an explanation of the implications of the common representation and the advantages and risks involved. Here, the referee properly concluded that the written waivers that were produced were entirely inadequate to advise the clients of the significant risks of proceeding with Truman's representation. Nowhere in the conflict waiver, as I've already emphasized, is there an explanation of the risks of entering into these transactions with Truman, any explanation of the implications of common representation, an explanation about how Mr. Truman's interest may be limited, or his self-interest may be limited in future transactions, or an explanation of any alternatives. Mr. Truman wore many hats in these transactions. At some times, he wore the hat of an attorney. At other times, he wore the hat of a creditor. In other times, he wore the hat of a landlord. Mr. Truman was dealing with unsophisticated individuals. They didn't have the capacity or the ability to determine which hat was Mr. Truman was wearing at any given time. All they saw was the attorney hat when they were dealing with Mr. Truman. Examples of Mr. Truman's self-interest as found by the referee is Mr. Truman's charging of the standard interest charges that he was charging, including, you know, putting loan preparation fees and bank fees in his loans without explanation to the clients as to what this was actually for. With the Hurleys, Mr. Truman volunteered to distribute funds when they had sold portions of their property off. He never explained to them that he would have a self-interest in distributing those funds as a creditor of the Hurleys during those transactions. He didn't even have them sign a conflict waiver at that time, despite the fact that he made sure that he was paid off as their creditor, that his loans were taken care of, and also that he was receiving attorney's fees for those transactions as well. Furthermore, even more egregious is the situation where the Hurleys were going to sell their property to Mr. Truman had already owned the Hurleys' property. The Cruises came to the Hurleys indicating they wanted to purchase a portion of their property. The Hurleys believed that this would be a way for them to actually buy their property back from Mr. Truman. And they went to him saying, hey, can we buy this property? Can you sell this property? Can we buy your property back? Mr. Truman said, sure. He never explained to them that they were never going to get their property back as a result of this transaction. Mr. Truman admits during that transaction that his interests were adverse. However, he never had them sign a conflict waiver for that transaction. He never explained to them that he was not representing them in that transaction. As a result, Mr. Truman sold the property to the Cruises. He paid off some of his loans. He received over $80,000 in capital gains taxes that were estimated that he never actually paid. Plus, he paid himself $1,500 in attorney's fees for that transaction. He gave the Hurleys $110,000, but he never explained to the Hurleys why they were receiving the $110,000, or that $110,000 was in exchange for them giving up their right to repurchase the property. There's nothing in writing even explaining if that $110,000 was reasonable. The referee emphasized in his report that it's difficult to comprehend how it is that the respondent is again before this court on facts and charges which so closely mirror for those for which he was disciplined less than a decade ago. It is distressing to think that on the eve of his suspension in 2005, he was rushing through yet another transaction in which he so blatantly attempted to take advantage of his clients. Listening to him testify, it was apparent that the only part of this court's earlier opinion which made any impression on him at all concerned the need to obtain written conflict waivers. It is as if the respondent lives on another planet. Rather than causing him to focus on the inherent risks, the respondent treated the drafting of conflict waivers as just another document to get his clients to sign, just another inconvenience. Most importantly, while his conduct was serious, had serious adverse consequences for his clients, there was always a secondary concern for the respondent, if there was a concern at all. At the hearing, the respondent expressed no remorse. Truman used his law license to gain the trust of unsophisticated farmers who were in dire financial circumstances. He abused that trust by taking their property from underneath them. Based upon Mr. Truman's previous disciplinary history, Wisconsin precedent, and the ABA standards for imposing lawyer sanctions, a revocation as recommended by the referee is the appropriate sanction in this case. The OLR would ask this court to uphold the findings of the referee, uphold the legal conclusions that Truman engaged in misconduct in 14 counts of the disciplinary case, and that this court revokes Attorney Truman's license to practice law.
Is there any request for restitution?
The OLR has thought long and hard about restitution. In terms of restitution, the OLR standards are that there has to be a reasonably ascertainable amount, that the funds to be restored were in the respondent's direct control, and that the funds to be restored do not constitute incidental or consequential damages, and that the grievance or respondent's right to a collateral proceeding will not likely be prejudiced. Also under SCR 21.16.2M, there is an ability to pay monetary restitution to a person whose money or property was misappropriated or misapplied. The problem in this case is that Mr. Truman's accountings were so inaccurate that the OLR could not paste everything together. We couldn't figure out how much money the clients actually paid him, what loans were actually out there, what amounts actually went on loans, what amounts went on to lease payments. So it was very difficult for OLR to actually come up with a restitution amount in this case.
What about zeroing out any loans that may still be outstanding?
The OLR was following our policy. This court has generally followed OLR's policy in ordering restitution. However, if, you know, it's this court's ability to put together what they feel is necessary. I don't think this court has ever put together an actual solid policy as to what this court is going to order in restitution situations. And so restitution is up to this court. In the alternative, this court could order under 2229-4M that Mr. Truman show that these clients were properly provided restitution prior to any reinstatement to the practice of law. I do also know that, at least with the Hurleys, they are currently in the midst of a civil proceeding with Mr. Truman, and it has not been resolved, and so that might shed some light on restitution issues as well. Thank you.
Could I ask one question? At the hearing before the referee, did Mr. Trewin describe any situations in which he acquired property from a client and it worked out beautifully?
Not that I'm aware of.
Any other questions? If not, then thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Mr. Trium.
Very briefly, I'd like to address the last question that you raised. There have been, in fact, a number of clients that have received their property back by making payments. In the first OLR proceeding, there was Randall and Londa Phillips that I purchased their property at sheriff's sale, entered into a, I believe I gave them the a land contract on the property right away, and they were able to purchase that property back. Seeley, I remember the last name, is Don and Judy Seeley was part of that proceedings as well. They were able to make the payments on that and get their property back without any problems. Steve and Marcia Yonke also bought their property back. The question was never raised at that trial, but there are, have been, in fact, a number of clients that were able to make the payments and get the property back. I also wanted to clarify a couple things. First of all, with regard to Attorney Morrow, the record from the first trial, or from the Groshek trial, will show that the judge questioned Attorney Morrow as to whether or not he was referred by me. Attorney Morrow did, in fact, testify that I did not refer them to him. I believe I may have referred them to Attorney George Goyke. I don't generally see Attorney Morrow much in bankruptcy court, so he wouldn't be somebody that I would typically refer somebody to. There was also testimony from that, or discussion about testimony from Mrs. Groshek about being in shock over a first sale sign. With regard to the Grosheks, they fell behind in their payments. After they fell behind in their payments, they were in contact with me, and they decided that they couldn't afford the payments that they had under their lease agreement. So they only wanted to keep the house and 10 acres, which they would pay $700, I think it was, per month for that acreage. And at that point, I said, okay, if that's what you want, we'll lower the rent of that. And they made payments, I think, for 6 or 7 months on that the house and 10 acres, after which time I had the remaining acreage put up for sale because they had talked about wanting to buy that back, but they never actually were able to do that. So the fact that she was in shock over the for sale sign, I don't know what that means, to be honest with you, but the fact of the matter is she knew that they had given up that acreage when they amended the lease to only provide for the house and 10 acres. With regard to the Van Strattons were buying the property back on an unrecorded land contract. In 2005, I believe it was, the Van Strattons did come in to see me regarding a reverse mortgage. They had already talked to a lender about a reverse mortgage, but there wasn't any equity for a reverse mortgage. They had to come up with $25,000, I think. There are, in the record, some printouts that we had made the day that they came into the office that showed that we looked at the a reverse mortgage, but it just didn't qualify because of the amount of debt that was owed on the property. It was at that point that we talked about the life lease. Now, unfortunately, I cannot find the documents from the life lease. And the referee says that without the documents, oral testimony isn't enough. However, in this particular case, there is other evidence other than the oral testimony that, in fact, there was a life lease. Mainly that Mr. Van Stratton, right after this, the date when this life lease was entered into, signed or started paying a different amount to me for rent. And he indicated on the checks that it was for rent. You know, to say 5 years after the fact or 7 years after the fact that I didn't realize that I wasn't buying it on land contract when, in fact, he had put rent on the checks, you know, isn't really very credible.
Mr. Treeland, I'm not clear, and I would like this brought up. I don't think I've heard it yet. Do you take issue with all of the referee's conclusions of violations, or are there any that you agree to?
Your Honor, there's one that I have to agree to. There was an $825 transfer fee that was on a spreadsheet, a closing document that was deducted from the sale of the Hurleys. That obviously should not have been deducted from the purchase price. I believe he characterized it as intentional. It was unintentional from my point of view. I did not refund them the money right when I found out about it, in part because they owed me substantially more than the $825, but I did acknowledge immediately that the $825 was, in fact, should have gone to them. It shouldn't.
And the other conclusions you believe are clearly erroneous?
I believe, without having the opinion in front of me, but I think that the rest of them are, I believe, clearly erroneous. And one of the reasons I say this is, for instance, the Van Strattons, I believe after the first OLR proceeding up until now, I believe that there was 7 or 8 different transactions that I entered into with them, most of them small loans. They signed written waivers of conflict of interest for all of them. I was able to produce the originals only of, I think, 6 or 7. I'm at fault. I'm the one who can't find the originals of the other documents. But they signed numerous documents a number of times indicating that they knew that this was an adverse relationship, that they had the right to hire their own independent counsel. So I don't think, given the history, that you can say per se that there's that oral testimony on the issue of whether or not they received the written conflict waivers is barred. I think that that's incorrect.
Thank you, counsel. And we are in recess. We should meet in the conference room at 2 o'clock.